audio has started. Welcome, Your Honor. It's not that I'm not a lawyer or anything. I don't go to court, but I just like saying Your Honor. Welcome. We appreciate your interest and joining us this morning. I think you're aware of the process. We will turn it over to you for opening comments and in 5 minutes or so about why you're interested in serving on the University of Minnesota Board of Regents. We'll then open it up for questions from the RCAC members. And then before the end, we'll turn it back to you for any kind of closing, any rebuttals or anything that you'd like to offer. So, Ms. Mayron.
All right, thank you. And let me all say to you, there's no need to call me Your Honor. It's been 2 years since I retired.
You may be appearing before you.
Chairman Walter, to the members of the selection committee, I am absolutely thrilled to be here today and to have this opportunity to speak to all of you about my interest in the position as a regent of the University of Minnesota. What I'd like to do in my brief presentation is give you a little bit of idea about my background. Obviously, you have my little bio there as well, but I want to tell you a little bit about my background and then talk to you about why it is I want to be a regent and why I believe I'm qualified to be a regent. I grew up in St. Paul and went to Highland Elementary, Highland Junior High, Highland Senior High, and thank goodness there was no college. I fear I may have ended up going to Highland College. Instead, I went to the University of Minnesota in 1969. At that time, my first year, I lived at home. And then on my sophomore year, I moved on to campus. I got my BA in sociology, specializing in social psychology with a minor in theater in 1973, and then immediately went to law school at the University of Minnesota and graduated from law school in 1976. After I graduated from law school, I was in private practice for nearly 27 years in three different law firms, where I specialized in civil litigation, a variety of different substantive topics in civil litigation as a trial lawyer and counselor, and I developed a very robust mediation practice. In 2003, I was appointed by the federal district judges of the District of Minnesota to be their magistrate judge in Minnesota. There are currently either 8 or 9 magistrate judges or maybe more that serve all of the district judges throughout the federal court system here in Minnesota, and I was appointed in 2003. I held that position for 14 years when I retired in February of 2017. So it's been nearly 2 years since my retirement, hence my comment about I don't think you need to call me Your Honor anymore. My kids call me, my grandchildren call me JJ, Judge JD. That's what my name is. So they carry it over. During my time in private practice and also while on the bench, as you can see from my resume, and I'll talk a little bit more in my presentation, I was involved in a variety of different organizations, both legal and non-legal in the community, holding a variety of leadership positions that I think bear on my qualifications to be a regent here at the University of Minnesota. So why do I want to be a regent and why do I think I'm qualified? Let me talk first about why, and it really goes back to the seed as I think back on this. And by the way, my friends and family, when I indicated I was going to apply, two of the ones said, why do you want to be a regent? In part because of the time, the complexity of the issues, and I'm retired now. And some would say I'm kind of living the dream right now in retirement. Why would I want to take on this responsibility? And it really has to do with when that seed was planted, back when I was a freshman and sophomore at the university, and then carrying over to my experience on the board and then as president of the Alumni Association, the University of Minnesota Alumni Association. So as I indicated, initially I lived at home. This is 1969, and I was commuting to campus. And to be honest, while I could tell I was going to get an excellent education at the university, I also felt pretty lost as a commuter. You're living at home, you go to class, your parents or whomever you pick you up, or if you have a car, you drive back home, and this goes on day in and day out. And I really had no connection to the university other than my classes. So in my sophomore year, I decided I'm going to move on to campus, and I did. And at that time, to be honest, 1970, fraternities and sororities were kind of on the downswing at that point. People were more interested in things like SDS or the Black Panthers or something like that. So I didn't join a fraternity or sorority. I moved onto campus, found three other roommates, and then what I did is I intentionally got very involved in the university, as much as I think a person who isn't part of the sorority or fraternity system could do. I became a freshman camp counselor. I ran for Senate, for the student senate, and was a student senator. I got into the honors program, which allowed me to take small classes from professors. And then I got involved in the array of activities that the university offered, whether it was attending athletic events or going to Northrop for ballet or playing golf over at the University of Minnesota golf course. So I immersed myself in those activities, and when I left, to be honest, I felt very connected to the university and felt that I had managed to make an institution, which on the Twin Cities campus, I think was around 40,000 people in the undergrad area, if I'm remembering right, and to make it small and touchable for me. Fast forward, I get asked to be on the board for the Alumni Association in 1985, and I joined the board in 1986, where I served until 1995, and I was president from 93 to 95. And that experience really picked up where I left off as a commuter, then residential student, immersing myself in activities. So when we were doing, as I remember it anyway, and Margaret may correct me because she was there as well, but we got involved in doing strategic planning and working with the university to address a number of issues. And they were related. One of them was that the Alumni Association was pretty stagnant in terms of membership. We hadn't grown substantially over a period of time, and the question was why. And at the same time, the university was experiencing some issues not dissimilar to what it experiences today. Funding was going down from the legislature, tuition was going up, and graduation rates were unacceptable. And so one of the things that came out of the work that we did through the Alumni Association, and that I was involved in as a board member, as president, was to take a look at why our alumni membership was small, or wasn't growing, I should say, but also what it is that we could do to assist the university in the decreased funding and the rising tuition rates and graduation rates. And ultimately, what I remember, the seed was planted through the UMAA that what we needed to do is we needed to convert the campus, which was predominantly commuter, I think about 80% at that time, at least the Twin Cities campus, to a residential campus. That if you were going to look to students post-graduation to get involved, to give money, and obviously that donors can make up rising tuition costs, and to give time, you needed those alumni to feel a connection to their university. And they weren't going to if they were living at home. They needed to have the kind of university experience that I did, where it personalized it and connected the individuals to the university. And so we began to work with the university to talk about how they could build, or through private investment, build additional residences on campus. During that time period, the Alumni Association said, we gotta get more visible. I think we were up in Kauffman Union on the fourth floor. Up there, no one could see us, and we worked very hard and ultimately ended up with our own alumni center, which is the McNamara Center. And then we worked on graduation rates. We developed a mentorship program between the alumni and students, hopefully to help individuals graduate sooner. And we increased and expanded the legislative outreach of the alumni to the legislature, hopefully to be able to get the message out about what this institution was and how important it was to the state and the state's well-being. And it didn't all happen when I was there. I'm not trying to say it did, but the genesis, I believe, those seeds were planted when I was there. And that's when the seed got planted for me. When I finished my involvement as a board member, as president, of saying, you know, someday I'd like to be a regent of the University of Minnesota. And I remember saying to Margaret and to others, you know, board members don't lose their love for an institution when they cycle off as board members. They're still very involved and they still want to assist. And so that's where my interest as a regent appeared. And then moving forward, obviously, we're many years later, but the timing wasn't right or the positions weren't there. Or when I became a judge, clearly the timing was not going to be opportune. And it was not until this cycle when I saw that there were two at-large positions, the 5th District, which is where I am, that they were open. And most importantly, that I had the time to commit, that I decided to apply because I wanted to be a regent. So that's why I'm here today. In terms of my qualifications, I think that I'm qualified for this position, and what I bring to the table is because of my temperament, because of my skill set, and because of my governance experience. So in terms of temperament, as a judge and as a mediator, you were required to set aside any personal notions or agenda you may have about any particular topic or issue. And recognize you have them, but say that's not what we're promoting. What we're going to promote is what's in the best interests of the parties before me, or in this case, the university. So I come with that lens of saying that what I'm called upon to do, and what I was called upon to do as a judge and a mediator, is to have that unbiased temperament to be able to analyze issues. Then I come with the background of having to delve deeply into issues, and they're always new. Every day as a judge, I called the job brain candy, because every day was a new day. I had to learn something new, and it was exciting to go delve into something that I knew nothing about the day before. And I think, to be honest, at least for someone like me, who's not an incumbent, every day will be a new day for quite some period of time for the university, and perhaps for, if I am fortunate enough, my entire tenure as a regent. So delving into topics, putting my arms around them, asking questions, analyzing, and then collaborating with others to come up with a decision or a resolution is the skill set that I bring to the table. I also bring governance experience, and as you can tell from my resume, I was involved in a variety of legal related committees through the State Bar Association. I chaired the civil litigation section, the alternative dispute resolution section. I was appointed by the Minnesota Supreme Court to a number of advisory committees. And then on the community level, I was involved in 3 different organizations, and interestingly, looking back, they're all education related. Northern Clay Center was about teaching students how to throw pots, do clay. McPhail Center for Music, which I don't know if you knew, used to be owned by the University of Minnesota and was spun off in the late 90s, is an educational institution to foster and teach students, young and old, music. And there's lots of research about the impact of music on the brain and a person's education and ability to succeed. That institution, obviously nowhere near, not even close to the university, but has 5 campuses, 16,000 students, hundreds of partnerships with different groups throughout the community, is doing at a micro level, I think, obviously, what the university does at a macro level. And then, of course, the UMAA, where I held a variety of different positions. And through all those positions, I was involved in strategic planning, in the hiring and evaluation of the CEO, of onboarding CEOs, of doing a deep dive into what is appropriate governance, what is the appropriate role of a board of governors or a board of directors vis-a-vis management, including doing self-assessments of the board members themselves. So I have a long history of leadership experience, and I think you can see an appetite for leadership experience. So for all of those reasons, that's why I'm here today and think I would be able to serve the university well. And now, questions.
Thank you very much. I will start with the first question I think that I've asked everybody so far. It has to do with the university's land grant mission. As the state of Minnesota's land grant university, the university is a land-grant university. What does that mean to you, and what do you think it should mean to the people of Minnesota?
Well, the land grant mission, as you all know, we all know, has the three components, which is research and discovery, learning and teaching, and outreach and public service. And that mission, I think, was revised, if I'm remembering right, and I have it here, but 1994 is what, 1980, actually. So it dates back many, many years. And what it means to me is that we have an obligation through research, through teaching, and through community outreach to improve the lives not only of the students who come before us, but citizens of our state, the communities within our state, the nation, and the world. And we need to either see that the information that we have developed is imparted to those different stakeholders, or to collaborate with them so as to make it a better place for all of us. And so that's what this means to me, and it means as much to me today as it meant to me back when I was involved in the mid-80s and came on the board. I think it's as alive today as it was then.
Thank you. Councilmember Carlson.
New president coming on July 1, and if you're a regent, she would want to sit down with you on a one-on-one, and she would probably have looked at your sheet, know all about you, and so she would say, or what is the best advice you can give me as a new leader of this academic institution? What would you say to her?
I think what I would say to her, by the way, I did have the opportunity to observe her being interviewed, and even though I sat behind her, she was facing the regents. She was thrilled to listen to, for those of you who might have attended her interview. I think what I would say to President Gable is that clearly she has so much to offer in terms of her experience and background, and that the temptation would be to start off running with perhaps ideas that she put into place when she was in South Carolina. But initially, I think the best thing she could do is sit down and do exactly what she was doing with me, which is to sit down and meet people and listen, be able to develop a rapport with them, and begin to understand the issues as those individuals see it at that particular time, and to understand what are their particular, what they care about, and what they think is needed on a going forward basis. And so being a sponge at this point early on in terms of gathering information, and it's probably goes back to what I do, is that that's the way I handle things initially, is you may have some, as I say, preconceived notions, but those have to be set aside. You really need to sit down and educate yourself about this new, in her case, institution. And she's done a lot of work already. That was evident from her interview, but I think still resisting that temptation. And she has so many stakeholders to have a conversation with, to do listening, to do her listening with, whether it's the faculty or other members of the administration or the Board of Regents or legislators. So I think initially she needs to be a sponge, and she needs to listen and soak up what is important and what people are saying to her.
Next question. Senator Clausen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question about the University of Minnesota Law School. I think law school has been dropping in the national ranking over the years. I think we have a new dean within the last 1 or 2 years. How important is it that we move up in the ranking, and what are some of your thoughts on what's needed to make that happen?
Well, let me preface my response by saying I'm now going to respond to you as a citizen and former law student. And I say that because I think my job would be, before I started opining in a way that made a difference as to what the university or the law school should be doing, I really need to get more information about it. But I do know that its rankings have diminished. I do know that it, in terms of the students, the quality of the students has gone, in terms of scores and GPAs have gone down. And I don't know what the answer, why that is, which is why I need to get more information. But I do think it's absolutely critical that that needs to be examined and it needs to improve. That I clearly believe. But in terms of how to do it at this point in time, I really need to get a better understanding from the law school of what their explanation is. And I think this goes back to, it's not me necessarily, it's the president, it's President Gabel and her administration, to get a better understanding of why the law school has dropped and what it believes and she believes it can do to improve standing. And to get an understanding also of what the law school doing compared to other law schools in terms of best practices. And is our law school following those best practices as well? So I don't know. I do know that the number of students have dropped nationwide and that there are more, the same number of schools vying for a fewer number of students. Whether that is an explanation or is solvable, I don't know. I would need more information.
Council Member Hipsch.
Thank you so much. We've talked through your work with UMAA and your personal experience on the Twin Cities campus. You have a lot of experience there. Talk to us a little bit about your experience with the coordinating campuses and how you might go about getting to know their unique missions and what they provide to their communities.
You're absolutely right. My focus, obviously, as a student, was on the Twin Cities campus. As a UMAA president, we were certainly aware that we had alum all over the state and they were being created by the different campuses at that time. At that time, we also had Waseca that we currently don't have. I would have to get immersed in. In fact, one of the things I was doing to prepare was to go and look at the different mission statements of each of the coordinate campuses to find out how it is that they are differentiating, if they are differentiating themselves, and who it is that they are seeking to as students, and what it is that they are saying is the niche that they provide. That said, they're so important to our land-grant mission, and they're so important to our touching all of the citizens throughout the state, that I think I would want to go up to each of the campuses, I would want to meet with each of the presidents, or if not that, then at least ask our new president, Joan Gabel, to provide that information to us, to the Board of Regents, so that we can get a better understanding of what each campus is providing, what they see their issues are, what they see is their path to success. I know that UMD, for example, is having diminishing numbers of students. And maybe that means the bright answer, they need to be a smaller campus. I don't know that. Or maybe it means they need to have a different approach. I also think it's incredibly important. We need to, obviously, any plan for the university has to take into account not only the Twin Cities campus, but those five campuses. And whether that means all of the campuses provide the same programs at each location, or rather they each focus on different particular areas and create special niches for each area, that's something that I would want to get more and a better understanding about.
In the state of Minnesota, we have two higher education systems,
yes.
Both the University of Minnesota and the Minnesota State system.
Yes.
Minnesota State also has a lot of campuses across the state. How would you go about building partnerships between the two systems?
I would be absolutely partnerships or collaborations with those two systems, I think, are critical. Those systems are responsible for educating the citizens of Minnesota and ultimately providing a workforce for the state of Minnesota. So I think we need to be talking with them, whether it means creating partnerships with them or ways of funneling particular students or areas to one area or another. Again, I don't have an answer to how to do it, but I have a clear interest in not having blinders and say, well, we're the University of Minnesota system and we don't need to be concerned with Minsku or the private colleges. We just need to be concerned with ourselves. That would be such a small-minded view of how to educate the citizens of Minnesota. I do think, though, with diminishing funding, diminishing resources, we have to be strategic, and that's where I think some sort of collaboration or transparency between these different systems so that we each understand what role we are playing. And I would hope try to avoid overlap, particularly when it creates overlap on the cost side of running an institution.
Thank you. Vice Chair Taylor.
You mentioned unbiased temperament as a strength, something you learn over time as a judge and a mediator. Give us an example of how you used your unbiased temperament skills in a challenging situation with one of your governance roles. Hopefully it wasn't with the UMAA because you and I served together on the board. And that would really be embarrassing if you use that as an honor. But McPhail, one that comes to mind.
Sure. Well, one that comes to mind is when I was chairing the governance committee, we took a look at the issue of whether there should be limits on the number of terms that a board member could hold. And at that time, the bylaws provided that a board member could serve for two terms, and if exceptions arose, they could be asked to serve additional terms. And when I was in charge of governance, what we were finding is the exception was swallowing up the rule, that by and large, we were asking people to remain on the board for more than two terms. And sometimes they were on, and I was a perfect example of someone who was on for multiple terms. So we went around and we looked at other boards and looked at best practices, and ultimately we came up with a decision that we would not put a limit on the number of terms that a board member could hold, that as long as they were being effective and filling a skill that was needed or something that was needed, a qualification on the board, that it would be appropriate for them to be on two, three, and maybe even more terms than that. And that we were basically honoring the reality of what was going on. So I'm chair of this. We work up all these documents. We put it into writing. And then next year, a new individual joins the governance committee. And he has the absolute opposite point of view. And he is very adamant that we should just have two terms. And his reasoning was that even if people were qualified and were adding value, you needed new blood. The only way an institution could stay nimble on a going forward basis is you had to ensure that there was new blood. So my bias, and clearly the stake, I had put the stake in there based on the work that we had collectively done, was we don't need terms, we'll just evaluate on a going forward basis the effectiveness of each board member. And by the way, with that, we developed a whole assessment tool so that we could assess each board member there and their effectiveness. So we were going to take on that job of evaluation. But in the end, he persuaded, I had to listen, because he was coming from a different perspective with a different set of experiences and being involved on different boards. And what he was suggesting, in my view, was in the realm of reason. And so I had to set aside that bias I had, and clearly that stake of the outcome. And ultimately, a couple years later, McPhail flipped itself and put in limits, and so it was a two-term limit, with the idea of really working to encourage to get new people on the board to drive it on a going forward basis. So that's one example that comes to mind.
Thank you.
On the governance side.
Councilmember Carlson has a follow-up.
A follow-up to that. We're dealing with exactly the same situation. We have one candidate among the candidates that would like 18 years. And What if you were sitting in this room and you were with us on Friday morning? What brilliance would you share with us?
Can I decline to answer? Yes. I would say you're all so brilliant, I cannot imagine anything you wouldn't think. You know, those are very tough decisions because, and I obviously we're talking about Dean Johnson, I understand that, and he's been, I'm going to assume he's been a terrific regent. I'm just going to go there, and that he's had. He served the university well. And so it's that balancing that you have to go through to decide what it, looking at, I think, your current board makeup and then looking at what he brings to the table and what are you trying to fill, skill set or otherwise? Is he the only one who can fill it? What's the value of new blood? Those are not, they're both, in my view, in the realm of reason. Either way, they're in the realm of reason, those responses. And so I'm sure you'll come to the right result.
Councilmember Rogers.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And thank you, I'm not sure how to address it. Judge Janie, is it?
Yeah, Judge Janie.
I can't help but getting images of that TV judge.
Judge Judy.
I'd like to ask a question related to Senator Clausen's question, and this relates to the medical school. I'm a graduate of medical school, and it's a significant portion of the university's budget is the health sciences. They produce 80% of the practicing physicians in the state. And over the last several years, similarly, their standings have decreased, especially in the last 20 years or so. And any opinions or ideas that you may have on how to improve that standing, noting that they have recently come to a new agreement with the Fairview system, but your opinions about that?
Well, again, I have in some sense the same response I gave to Senator Clausen about my views are as a citizen and what I'm reading, but I will tell you, I am so encouraged by this new collaboration, partnership relationship that the university has now put in place. It's a continuation with Fairview, the mHealth Fairview partnership. From what I read about it and what I have heard, talking with individuals who were either on the Fairview board or were on the university side, is they are so encouraged by this partnership and the relationship and the synergy between the two chairs, the Dean Toler, and the chair of Fairview. And they are very hopeful that it is going to do a variety of things, but one of them, from what I can tell, is that there's going to be an influx of significant dollars that is going to come in from Fairview to the University Medical School to fund research and hopefully improvement of facilities. And all of that, my memory is, we're talking about, and you all will know better, I'm sure, $50 million, I think, through 2022 or within the next couple of years. So a significant amount of dollars to upgrade and upgrade facilities, but enhance our research. And those, I know that research and the outcome of research in terms of innovation drives up standing or rankings within the country. Now, whether that's an appropriate metric, I don't know the answer to that. As I understand it, we measure, rankings are measured by NIH grants. How much you get in, as opposed to output in terms of what is it that you did with those dollars and what patents or innovations or issues did you solve. But assuming those are the metrics, it seems to me that there is an opportunity to increase our rankings back to where they were some decades ago, where we were in the top 10 of the medical schools, and now I understand I think we're around 30 or 32. So there's been a significant drop. But I think that infusion of money and energy, I think, is going to go a long way, I hope, to improving the rankings. Now, that's me saying broad picture, but now the administration needs to get into the weeds to make sure that they are using the correct measures and metrics to judge the success of this partnership, and is it making a difference in terms of our rankings?
Thank you.
Council Member Menon.
All right. Thank you for being here today.
Thank you.
My question revolves around the issue of crisis management. The University of Minnesota has faced a myriad of crises in the last few years, and I'm interested in hearing how you would pursue crisis management and how you take into account collaboration with other, or the fact that you're making that decision in a collaborative setting with the other regions.
I think that crisis management, if it's not part of the strategic plan, has to be part of wherever it belongs, has to be one of the top issues that the university is prepared to address. And I reflect on actually what President-elect Gabel said during her remarks. There are those crises that you can anticipate and put in place processes to immediately jump on them, investigate them, and address them. And then there are those you cannot anticipate. And at a minimum, and I agree with that, and at a minimum, we need to make sure that we have put our best thinking forward to be able to have processes in place to anticipate any crisis that certainly has occurred on our campus or other campuses or other institutions or around the world, because they could happen here. We just can't name them. So I think the main thing is to plan for them, and then to have a plan of what's it going to look like when you hit that one, that anomaly you didn't plan, and what's the plan to address the anomalies. I would expect with any crisis it will start with the president and her office to address it, but clearly the Board of Regents has to be there, I would hope, collaboration, input, and ultimately support from the Board of Regents on how to manage that crisis.
Thank you.
Councilmember Brady.
Judge, thank you for being here this morning. I have a question that goes back a little bit in time. In corporate America, it's dynamic. There's acquisitions, roll-ups, and changes. I recognize that law firms are businesses too, and dynamic, and there's a lot of changes. But going back in time, there was a law firm, Popham Hake, that I know you worked with. It was one of the truly thriving law firms in the state. I see you were involved with governance there, and then it ceased to exist. I just don't know a lot about that, and I was wondering if you had any comment about that.
There were so many. You're absolutely right. So at one point in time, I think it was like the third fastest growing firm in the United States with offices in different parts of the world. And in 97, it, as I say, it imploded. And at that point, I went to Leonard Street and Dinard. You know, looking back on it, initially, the economy had played a huge role in it. And the firm had focused its, or whether it had focused, its revenues were being driven by one particular client, a substantial part of the revenues. And those cases, it was a piece of litigation nationwide, ended. And that revenue stream dried up. And then all of a sudden, you have a firm that now has all of these institutional costs that it still is committed to, rent and people, that don't disappear just because a case disappears. And so it put economic pressure on the firm and some individuals within the firm. Some of my partners within the firm saw what was going on in terms of economics and decided they could perhaps do better if they were on their own in a smaller group. And they began to spin off, and then it becomes kind of a roller coaster at that point. And at some point then, it wasn't viable anymore. The good news was with what happened with Popham, and I think this is, I can say this, this is true compared to other firms who also imploded after Popham, is that it in fact it landed itself with another law firm, and it did, it paid all its bills, it never went into bankruptcy, and so it met its commitments to everyone. And that gave those of us who stayed to the very end a lot of comfort at the very end. Interesting with lessons learned, and it reminds me of the comment that, is it Dr. Rogers? Dr. Rogers, you mean. about the medical school. You know, there's a risk when your revenues are tied up in a substantial area. And as I think back, you know, the medical school contributes an enormous amount of the revenues here, and that's the good news. But the bad news is if it, those revenues get affected, it affects the entire institution. And so on a going forward basis, I think it inures to everybody's benefit to try and drive revenue streams in a variety of different areas and not just in one single area, which wasn't true with Popham, but it just happened to be that this major case created a ripple effect that we just couldn't stop.
Council Member Moore.
Thank you, Chairman. Thank you so much for being here, Judge Janey. Yeah. So Minnesota is a very vibrant, and it's becoming a more diverse state, and the Twin Cities is an extremely diverse metropolis, yet our state is one of the worst in terms of racial equality. People of color continue to face significant disparities. In your opinion, what's the role of the university in building a more equitable environment for all people to succeed?
I think we have to, that we would entertain relationships that with individuals who are in K through 12. In other words, I think we can't wait until somebody graduates high school. Part of the issue is not graduating high school. And so I think we need to begin to, if we aren't already, and I don't know the answer to this, collaborating with our counterparts in K through 12. In order to work with them and do what we can and provide what resources we have or expertise to try and reach students at starting when they are preschool or going into school, and so as to foster their interest and to nurture them all the way through so that they will complete high school and then have an interest in joining the university or another higher education institution, whether it's in Minnesota or somewhere else. So just as we can't have blinders with the other higher education institutions, systems in Minnesota, I don't think we can, and I doubt we do, but I don't know, have blinders in terms of what's going on through K through 12. So interestingly, with now the legislature going into session here and seeing what's in the newspaper, all of a sudden I find myself now reading a lot more about, you know, what's the thinking about K through 12 and what are we talking about with dollars through K through 12, because that not only impacts Minnesota, but it's going to impact what's going to happen ultimately here at the university. I also think, though, there are issues, there's acquisition of and trying to address inequality by doing away with it and hopefully getting all students ready for higher education. But there's also then retention. That's an issue as well. And so it's one thing to train them and get them ready and bring them in, but then it doesn't stop there. You have to work with them to see that they stay with the system and complete the education as well.
And final question, Councilmember Erickson.
Thank you, Chairman. Just actually, this is, I asked to go last, this is more of a comment than a question. A couple things. I was on the leadership at Larkin Hoffman at the time that Popham Hake went to South, and it's a great credit to you and your colleagues that stayed there that they did pay all the bills. That's credit to the unit, to the whole legal institution. Compliments on that. Secondly, I want to follow up on the temperament. You used the word, and so did Council Member Taylor. Last night I was reading, I was given a book called by Doris Kearns Goodwin that's known about leadership in troubled times. It's about Abraham Lincoln, Teddy Roosevelt, and Franklin Roosevelt. And I was just last night reading the section that talked about Franklin Roosevelt's key traits, and it applied to the other two. And the one that was used was temperament. That temperament is so critical, and so I just suggest that as I'm glad you lifted it up and Paul noticed it, and I think that's true, and it's a screen for us to use. A comment Oliver Wendell Holmes, after he met Franklin Roosevelt, said, second-rate intellect, but first-rate temperament. So for what it's worth.
May I say she has first-rate intellect.
I understand. That was Franklin Roosevelt. I was lifting up temperament. And then lastly, I would say, you know, you're another JJ. There's a Judge Judy, and yeah. I read that she makes $75 million a year. Why didn't you do that?
I'm devoted to public service.
That concludes.
You're not the first to ask. And maybe it was that minor in theater just wasn't enough.
Well, that concludes our questioning then. We'll turn it back to you if you've got any closing statements.
Just very briefly. Again, I thank you for this opportunity. This whole process falls within what I call the Brain Candy Trust. I am not, as I would say, a political person, meaning I vote. But I haven't been involved in the political arena. So being involved in this whole process at the initially, when I was told about it, well, it fell into the daunting description. But then shortly after, it became one of those, this is really interesting. I am really learning something. And so whether ultimately you select me as a regent or not, the fact is I've gotten so much out of this process and being able to be here and to get to even the table here to have this discussion with you here today. And I thank you all for giving me that opportunity.
Thank you. Appreciate your time.